CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Et vous écoutez CKUT 90.3 à Montréal.
Ok, oh, merci beaucoup.
If you're young at heart, for it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind. If you're young at heart, you can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams, and life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young at heart? For it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind when you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here's the best part, you have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live on CKUT 90.3 in Montreal. We come to you monthly every second Wednesday. My name is Laura Yaris and I'll be your host today. We're going to rerun an interview this evening that I did last July with Professor Dr. Elaine Leader, who did some fascinating research and interviews with older Jewish women anarchists who were active between 1920 and 1950. It's an incredible body of work about these women, and I'm happy to bring it to you once again. We're going to wrap up the show with a conversation I had with our sister collective member, Rosemary Wally, about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, given that this Friday, December 10th, is International Human Rights Day. We'll have a little bit of music for you as well. But first, on behalf of the entire Older Women Live Collective, I would like to express our deepest condolences to our dear sister collective member, Marlène Rateau, who recently suffered a death in the family. Please know that you have our support, and may your family be spared further sorrow. And now let's get right into our rerun of Professor Elaine Leader. Here's a little background on Elaine Leader. She holds a master's degree in social work from Yeshiva University, a master's in public health from University of California at Berkeley, and a PhD from Cornell. She's a professor emerita of sociology and the dean emerita of the School of Social Sciences at Sonoma State University in California. Previously, she was a professor at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York. She has over 40 years of distinguished accomplishments and experience in academia and public service. She's received numerous awards and grants and has published 5 books and numerous articles on various subjects. For example, her book, My Life with Lifers, Lessons for a Teacher, Humanity Has No Bars, describes her work at San Quentin State Prison and Elmira Correctional Facility. Currently, she does victim-offender dialogues in prisons across the state of California. She was born in Lynn, Massachusetts, to a working-class immigrant family. Her mother's family was from Poland, and her father got out of Lithuania in 1939, just as World War II was beginning. His family was killed in 1941 in their hometown of Kupiskis. Elaine believes that this incident has informed her identity in deep and profound ways. She's always been dedicated to understanding how people can harm others and what motivates them to do vicious things. She's been involved in promoting social justice in various ways all her life, first marching with Martin Luther King Jr. in Boston, engaging in civil rights activities, anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, women's rights movements, mental patients liberation, gay rights, Black Lives Matter, and now #MeToo. She worked her way through college and graduate school and was able to overcome the socialization that would have had her become a homemaker, mother, and wife. She held those roles, and she was also a social worker, a psychotherapist from 1967 to 1992, when she worked in mental hospitals, gerontology, foster care, drug and alcohol counseling, and domestic violence as a therapist. And she's been a college professor from 1977 to today, and a writer since the early 70s, and an activist all her life. I recently became acquainted with her through a presentation she gave over Zoom for the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research. The topic was Jewish Women Anarchists between 1920 and 1950. I found her talk so interesting and exciting, I just had to contact her myself, and she graciously agreed to do the interview you're about to hear. So Professor Leader starts off by explaining how she came to interview these fascinating, colorful, and amazing women.
I was working on my PhD at Cornell in the 1980s when I was writing about Rose Pisoda, who was an anarchist labor organizer, one of the women I'll talk about later. And as a result of doing that book, I interviewed a bunch of older anarchist women, and I was so smitten with them. I just thought they had such fabulous stories that I went back after I finished the book, and I began in about 1986 to do the interviews because I'd gotten a grant from my college. And then later I was in an NEH seminar, National Endowment for the Humanities seminar on women called The History of Women Through Social Movements, and we were supposed to do oral histories, and I just went back and dug up the material I had done and interviewed a few more people. So I kind of finished this in 1996, and I tried to publish it, but nobody was really very interested, and I went on to other matters. And then all of a sudden there's a resurgence of interest in anarchism as an ideology and these women as examples of living their lives anarchistically. And so I called the work Anarchist Women 1920 to 1950, The Politics of Sexuality, because their behavior was really outside of the norm for people, for women of that generation. So that's how it all began.
We hear about Emma Goldman. She was an anarchist, and there's a lot of information about her, and she had a pretty colorful life and all that. But you named so many other anarchist women who we never heard of. And I mean, I'm really glad that there's some kind of resurgence or whatever, and that we can find out more about this. Are there any plans in the works now to get this work published?
I have been invited to give two papers. One will be a scholarly paper for a book out of University of Illinois on anarchist contemporary and historical perspectives on anarchism. And then there's an anarchist journal out of Oxford, England, that's also interested. So I'm writing up the scholarly one, and then I'll write up the one for popular consumption later. But I'm really having a good time going back through the material, because these women, may I tell you something about them?
Yes, absolutely. That was going to be my next question.
Okay.
Please.
Well, first of all, let me situate them in an era. Remember that I'm writing from 1920 to 1950, and this is after the Red Scare, or during the Red Scare.
Yeah, really.
And so there was a lot of effort on the part of Americans to lay low, keep a low profile, not be too political. And it was also an era in which there were great expectations of what a woman should be. she should be a housewife, she should be a mother. If she wants to work, well, let her be a good housewife and mother first. And that was primarily, of course, for white middle class and upper class women. The women I studied were working class women. They worked as secretaries, they worked as seamstresses, and they were involved in activities that the mainstream were not involved in. They were, I'll tell you some of the details, but I kind of just want to situate them for you first.
Yeah.
They were all immigrants, and so English was not their first language, Yiddish was. They came to the United States in the teens, all expecting that, of course, the streets were paved with gold, as it was expected, but it wasn't. And many of them went to work in places where the conditions were pretty horrific. And so they were in sweatshops, they were in positions of being second-class citizens. One of them, Rose Pasota, the one that I did the biography on, actually got herself up to the position of vice president of the ILGWU, but she was the only woman on the board, and she was the only anarchist, and she was not heard. She was just marginalized. And so these women were living in an era, and I certainly remember it from my mother and from me growing up. It was kind of the expectations like you saw on the early shows of Mad Men. You know, very conventional kind of lifestyles. Women were supposed to be seen and not heard. Women were supposed to be good secretaries, but could never get to the position of CEO. And so these women rebelled. And they were need to be situated in their politics as well. They were anarchists. Now, most of us, when we hear the word, think that anarchists are chaos, bomb-throwing revolutionaries who just want a society that is a free-for-all. And that is very far from the truth. Anarchism has a really long, deep, rich philosophical political history. It goes back to Proudhon, Bakunin, Kropotkin, and these theorists, and even further back than that, really argued that there has to be ultimate freedom for all individuals, no matter what gender you happen to be. And most of the time, people argued that it had to come from the workplace. But many others talked about it in terms of individual relationships and the way that the power dynamics are operating in relationships. And so early anarchist thinkers were against marriage, because Emma Goldman wrote extensively on how women are victimized within marriage. They also believed in what was something that was called sexual varietism. And we might now call that non-monogamy or being polyamorous. But remember, this is the 1950s, 40s, and to be polyamorous and non-monogamous is sexual varietism is pretty unusual. And there were other, you know, there were free lovers and there were free thinkers during that time, but they were a minority. And so these women that I interviewed have interesting stories, but it's in the context of having come out of oppressive family life in Europe. Most of them were raised Orthodox Jewish, and one of them, Clara, was never allowed to be educated until she came to the United States. Her family was, I think there were 12 children, and none of the girls were educated. All of the boys went to yeshiva and learned a great deal, but not Clara. And that was not uncommon in those days. That was also true for the other women that I interviewed. So we're talking about a period of time that they're coming out of great repression and victimization, and they gravitated to the ideology of anarchism, which is complete freedom and independence from other people. And there really is a sense that they wanted true liberation, and that meant complete equality between the sexes and complete equality in terms of economic independence. And they wanted that for women at a time when women were not completely independent economically, except for working class women. Many of the women that I interviewed were the sole breadwinners of their families because the men that they were partnered with, not always married, were engaged in political activity. Many of the men went to the Spanish Civil War to fight with Abraham Lincoln Brigade. They were involved in the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, or the Wobblies. So they were out organizing. One of them was a sailor, a seaman, and he was out organizing on the ships. So these folks, these women, were home while these men were organizing, but they were also busy doing their political work. And they really didn't believe in the nuclear family per se. They thought it was a destructive institution and that they wanted to live an alternative lifestyle. In the 70s, you say something to the effect of, we want to build a new society in the vacant lots of the old. And these folks were living that. And they tend to be ostracized, if you will, from the mainstream because they were dressed unconventionally. They had numerous lovers at the same time. They sent their children to utopian schools. They created utopian communities, one called Mohegan, up in upstate New York on Mohegan Lake, where they were living a collectivist communistic, but not the big C communistic, little C communistic lifestyles. They were raising each other's children. They were leaving their kids here while they went out to organize. And so it was a pretty unconventional situation. That's why I really loved them too. I myself had been raised Orthodox and gravitated the first time I read Emma Goldman. That was it. I was hooked. I became an anarchist, wrote anarchist feminist theory in the 70s. And when I was looking for a dissertation topic, my advisor just said, oh, go take a look at Rose Pisoda. And the doors opened for me to meet these women who were, in fact, role models for me. I felt like I was taking their stories, living my life as I live it at that time, and carrying it to the next generation. And now there is a revitalization of anarchist women who are anarchist feminists. Now, let me say, these women would not have called themselves feminists. That was not part of the lingo, the ideology at the time. They were free lovers and they believed in sexual varietism. But feminism was not, they didn't march with the suffragists. They didn't affiliate with other organizations other than other anarchists because they couldn't adhere to looking to the state for solutions. They really believed that they had to live their lives as they lived them, and the state or the church or the synagogue couldn't give it to them. They had to take it for themselves. So that's kind of a bit of an overview on them. Do you want to hear about any of...
Let's hear some specific names that we can...
Well, I have to say, I do not use their real names except for two. Primarily because at the time I interviewed them, they wanted to remain anonymous. Now, all of them have died, and I could give you their names, but I... I'm afraid to do so because they wanted anonymity. And so I use a first name and an initial. They, you know, their children are still alive, and some of the things that I talk about are pretty private.
Yeah.
I know
no,
who
I get
slept
it.
At home and why they did it, you know, and what their kids thought. I need to keep their privacy.
Of course.
Even after their death. Anyway, so let me first tell you, I was just writing today about Clara. I met Clara, and I think she'd allow me to use her name. It was Clara Rothberg Larson. When I met her, she was in her 80s, actually probably her 90s. Yeah, she was in her 90s. And she had emigrated from Russia and she was one of 12 children not allowed to become educated. She traveled in steerage to come to the United States, allowed to come. And she was befriended by a sort of a wealthy American woman who sort of took her under her wing on the ship. And when the ship docked in New York, Clara's brother failed to meet the ship. And she was only 13 at the time, alone. And this American woman took her in and searched out the brother and eventually found the brother, but it was 3 to 5 days later.
Wow.
So can you imagine? So already you got a sense of this feisty kid coming to the United States. Very soon after coming to the States at 13, by 15, she was working in the garment industry as a seamstress and became so feisty and well-known for her agitation and articulateness that she got sent to a labor college. Now, labor colleges were places for working-class immigrant women to go. There was one at Brookfield, there was one at Bryn Mawr, there was one in Arkansas. They were all over the country, sponsored by wealthy Americans who wanted to educate immigrant women to organize, speak, and write on their own behalf. Wonderful idea. And many of these women went to these wonderful labor colleges. There's even a book about them. And she went and she learned community organizing. She learned to write in English, so she was pretty smart. And she learned to do public speaking and went back to the ILGWU, where she spent the rest of her life being a labor organizer, activist, and wrote for the anarchist journals. She told me a story in which she was arrested on the front lines of a strike where they were picketing in front of a sweatshop. She got arrested. She shows up at the police station, and there's her picture on the wall as one of the most wanted. And she says in Yiddish, give a keek.
Yeah, take a look at that, yeah.
Take a look to her friend, but she gives another name when she's arrested, and they let her go. And her picture is up on the wall. And she did that a number of times, and they never caught on that she was on that most wanted photo. She was like that. She was just a hoot. The other thing about her, which came much later in her life, it's kind of a capstone story of who she was. By this time, I think she was in her 70s. Yeah, it was the opening of Ellis Island Museum, which was around 1975, I think. But she was in a wheelchair because she was aging, and she was a representative of Russian immigrants. And because every ethnic group that came through Ellis Island had a representative, and she was for Russia. And Dan Quayle was the vice president of the U.S. at the time, a conservative Republican. And she was in a wheelchair, and he patronizingly puts his hand on her shoulder and says, "How wonderful it is to meet you, Clara." And she looks up at him from the chair, raises her fist, and says, "Gayevek. Go away. You're a goddamn Republican. I want nothing to do with you. You have done nothing good for this country. Go away from me." And in her 70s, you know, and she just was fabulous. I was lucky enough. She was the best friend of Rose Pasoda, the woman I wrote the biography about. So she gave me a lot of information on Rose, but I got her story afterwards. She was always working in anarchist circles. She was on the Sacco and Vanzetti Defense Fund, visited Sacco and Vanzetti in prison, was invited to the funeral, which thousands tried to get into, but she was invited, saw the funeral, and was present in the crematorium when they were cremated, which was quite an honor. So poignant and tough, but that's how important she was in anarchist circles. She wrote for Frei Arbeit der Stimme, which is the Free Voice of Labor, the longest lasting Yiddish newspaper in the country. She wrote for Road to Freedom, which was an anarchist magazine journal. She married a Danish sailor who was a member of the IWW, and he was always shipping out to sea and then coming back and shipping out to sea. She continued doing all of her organizing. She maintained a home. They had no children. And when he finally retired, they sold everything, bought a car, and traveled around the country for a year and a half, visiting anarchist communities throughout the country.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, people do that now in their RVs, but they stayed in anarchist homes, not motels, and, you know, lived frugally. She also told me stories that she spent time going to hear the talks by Emma Goldman, and she was very influenced politically and by the charisma and brilliance of Emma Goldman. But she told me some inside scoops. One was that when Emma would come to a house, she would insist on having the best bed in the house, which was often the marital bed of the hosts. She took it, like, you know, prima donna. The other thing she insisted on was having red roses on her podium whenever she spoke. So Clara didn't like that. She thought she was a little too privileged. So even the idol could be smashed in Clara's mind. She was a terrible cook. Even though she had been brought up Orthodox Jewish, she never learned to do the Jewish cooking. So she tried to cook me several times, cooked me Friday night dinner. And it was kind of funny because it was mostly burned and inedible. which I think also typifies the fact that she was an iconoclast and very independent and really stood by her principles. She was not going to be a housewife. She was going to be a political organizer for the rest of her life. And she supported her friends who were deported. Molly Steimer, who was a Jewish activist, was deported in 1921 under the sedition law because she had carried placards and banners opposing U.S. intervention in the Bolshevik Revolution. And so she was deported on sedition charges, moved to Russia, and then eventually to Germany. And then with World War II breaking out, she went to Mexico. Clara sent her money for the rest of her life. So she
Clara herself earn a living? Did she was she still working as a seamstress?
Organizer. So the union paid her for both. Well, she had worked piecework in the shops, being a seamstress, and then she worked for the ILGWU as a community organizer, and that too would be paid. You know, she had housing, the ILG housing on the Lower East Side of Manhattan when I visit her. You know, she lived in a very small apartment. She didn't have a lot of money, but she sure had a colorful life. I mean,
Sounds like it.
Yeah, it was fun to talk to her. I could tell you a little bit about Rose Posoda, the woman that I wrote the biography about. Rose, too, had come from Russia. She was allowed to be educated. Her father was a little more progressive. And as a young woman, she had learned from the itinerant scholars who came through the shtetls. The Haskalah, which was the Jewish Enlightenment,
yeah,
was taking place. And there were young men who would come with books and educate. And she also went to a private school. Her father was pretty comfortable, where she learned to read and write. So she, as a youth, before she came to the United States, carried anti-Tsarist brochures under her shirt, which is pretty scary. She could have been killed for doing that. But clearly she was drawn to being a radical. She wasn't yet an anarchist, but she was radical in Europe. And then her father wanted to marry her off. He wasn't that enlightened. And so she insisted and begged to come to the United States and came with her grandmother, who accompanied her, and then went to live with a sister who lived in New York City. And I got to interview the sister before she died, and she said to me, Rose believed in anarchism the way an Orthodox Jew believes in God. And because when Rose got to the United States, very early into her being here, she became a seamstress with the ILG, but she started to go to lectures. That's how people learned about these ideas. There were little halls in the cities where people would come and give beautiful lectures, well-presented lectures. I mean, Frederick Douglass did that, Emma Goldman did that, all the literary people of their times came through and gave lectures. And so she went to a bunch of lectures and learned about anarchism, was very drawn to the ideology, and actually took up with a man who was an anarchist, who she fell in love with. He was deported with Emma Goldman because of his political activities. And she kept up a correspondence with him in Russia until he married someone else and her heart was broken. Her real claim to fame was her colorful organizing style. She was brilliant, and eventually the ILG hired her to go all over the country to organize seamstresses. She organized in Los Angeles for a dress company where she had all of the women dress up in the clothing that they had sewn with picket signs that the children carried that said, "My mother can't afford to buy the dress that she made." And colorful. You know, she would have people in Halloween costumes. She was so militant that, in fact, some anti-union thugs gashed her once when she was in a telephone booth with a knife, and she had stitches to prove it. Wow. She was lent by the ILG to the CIO, the Congress of International Organizations, to do organizing in Flint, Michigan. And that's where she took up with a married man, Powers Hapgood, and had a long affair with him. She was a free lover, you know, what they would have called, or at least believed in sexual varietism. I should say something else about one of her lovers. It was actually a husband, Martin, Fred Martin, I think is his name. Anyway, he was a political organizer and an anarchist as well, and was about to be deported. And his ship was sailing out of the New York Harbor. Frank Martin. He jumped ship in the New York Harbor and swam back to port. She never saw him again. He got lost in the United States somewhere. But those are three of the people that I know of that she was involved with. Wow. But mostly she was extremely fine organizer. And then because of it, the ILG only allowed one woman to be on the board of the ILG, the executive board. And she was elected. She was the third woman to be in that position. And in that position, she really stood up for women's issues, for rank and file, for conditions that were down at the grassroots. And she was very marginalized, both as a woman and as an anarchist. Now, there was a big fight in the ILGWU when the Bolsheviks took over in Russia, because there were the communists, Big C communists, who wanted to take the union over and organize it as the Bolsheviks had done so in Russia. And then there were the other radicals, like Rose, an anarchist, who didn't want that central organizing committee hierarchy. She had heard of the failings of the Bolshevik Revolution already, and she fought against the Big C communists, the Reds. Ultimately, it almost brought down the ILG, but fortunately, I gather her side won, and they drove out the more radical, if you will, or more virulently militant Bolshevik types. She organized, went to Puerto Rico, she went to Canada, I mean, she was all over the place, and formed very strong relationships with the organizers of those communities. And that's probably how that went, because she had the resources of the ILG behind her.
Okay.
But she didn't have the knowledge of the local community, the local shops, the local culture. So she partnered up with local people to make it work. And they generally were successful in unionizing these sweatshops, and step by step by step by step. It was very impressive at the time what they were able to accomplish.
And how old was Rose Pasoda when she died?
Very young, yeah. Wow. She died in 1965. I think she was born in late 1890s.
Wow.
So she died of cancer. She died single. She did have a niece and a nephew. I was lucky enough that I met the niece and the niece's son. And they were living in Levittown, New York, and I pulled up, and there was an original framed photograph of Emma Goldman that had hung in Rose's house. There was a pen that was carved in ivory by Benzetti.
Wow.
That she gave to me, and all of these papers. Eventually, I gave the photograph of Emma Goldman to the Emma Goldman papers in Berkeley, because I thought that was more appropriate than in my living room. And I gave the Benzetti pen to the Boston Public Library, where all of their papers are housed. But I was honored to be able to keep them for about 20 years before I gave them away.
Wow.
So, yeah, she's buried in New Jersey, and one of my correspondents knew that I was interested. I'd never been to that cemetery, so he took a picture, so now I have a picture of her gravesite. And unfortunately, I didn't start this work until 1980s, and so I missed her, or I would have really enjoyed knowing her, interviewing her. I'd really like to summarize something about these women. I would say, you know, that they were really dedicated anarchists, and they identified that way. They came to the movement in their youth, and they stayed active for their entire lives. They lived and tried to live in their personal relationships, the ideology. So it was not just politics. It was the politics of sexuality, how they lived their relationships and their families.
Well, an early precursor of the personal is political.
Exactly, without ever calling it that. Some of them, by the way, I should tell you, I haven't told you their stories, but two of them were a little dismayed at how their children turned out. That, you know, the mothers had been out organizing, they live in communes and collectives, and the young people turned out, one of them said, "I raised a petty bourgeois bureaucrat." And that was the greatest regret of her life. And a few others said, "I don't think my children liked our lifestyle because they became monogamous and traditional." So the children rebelled. But these women didn't form close organizational ties with other women. They were in the anarchist world, not just the women's world, the way some of the other kinds of organizers were at the time, around suffrage and later, women's right to vote, etc. And they didn't adhere to what was expected of them as Jews and as women and as mothers and as homemakers. And they also were very colorful and delightful characters. They were charismatic. One woman, she wouldn't let me interview her, by the way. She said, "No, you're not going to exploit my story. I'm going to tell my story, not you." And I respected that, you know. And eventually I looked recently, and there really is, she finally did tell her story. So I'm glad that that happened.
How many women did you interview altogether?
I interviewed 8. However, not all of them were Jewish. So I focused my paper on the Jews. And that would have been only 5 plus Rose is 6. I didn't get to interview Rose. And as you said, they were living the personal is political before it became a catchphrase.
Right.
They're the ones who kept the ideology alive through generations, from the late 1800s to the 1970s, when feminism picked up the cudgel. And I also have to say, I was truly honored to be able to tell their stories. I wish I'd had more time to find more of them and tell more of their stories, because there are lessons to be learned from them about living in a time of repression, of living one's ideology when it's not sexy, when people are consumers not rather than activists. And in this case, they provide a role model for us, you and me and your listeners, and to younger generations as well. And that's one of the reasons I'm thrilled that the young anarchists are interested in these stories too. I heard from a young woman who goes to Oberlin, and she had come to my talk, and she said everyone she talked to in college at Oberlin, a rather liberal, radical university, wanted to hear these stories too. So I feel like I've been a transitional communicator.
So you got to write another book now.
Oh, I've got enough. This is my sixth. No, actually, that was my first. And now
the biography of Rose Pasota, you mean?
That's my first book, yeah.
So to learn about the other women, we'd have to read these papers that you're going to have published.
Yeah, I don't have enough for a book. You know, I only have six stories, basically, if I stick to the Jewish women, and eight if I just do it more broadly. So that's not a book.
If people are interested, once you publish these papers, where will they be able to find them?
Well, I have a website, www.elaineleader.com.
Okay.
And you can reach me. I can also be reached at leader, L-E-E-D-E-R, at Sonoma, S-O-N-O-M-A.edu. And I'm always happy to send a draft or when it's published to link. The scholarly paper, I think, is going to print in August. And the more public consumption one, as soon as I write it, probably by September, will be up online.
Nitzuch mechwu, die Märten grünen, gefinst mich dort, nicht mein Schatz. Wo Lebenswelken bei mir schienen, dort ist mein Ruheplatz. Dort ist mein Ruheplatz. Nicht such mich wo die Vögel singen, gefinst mich dort nicht mein Schatz. Ach, schlaf bin ich, wo Ketten klingen, dort ist mein Ruheplatz. Dort ist mein Ruheplatz. Nicht such mich wo Fontanen spritzen, ich find's dort nicht mein Schatz. Wo Tränen rinnen, Zähne kritzen, dort ist mein Ruheplatz. Dort
was Linda Hirschhorn and her group Vocalot singing Mein Ruheplatz in Yiddish. This is a song written by a sweatshop poet, Morris Rosenfeld, back in the 1920s. And the song basically says, don't look for me where the fountains spray or where the birds fly. I will be at my machine and that will be my resting place, my love. Before that, you were listening to an interview with Professor Dr. Elaine Leader. One of her books is actually about Rose Pasota. It's called The Gentle General, Rose Pasota, anarchist and labor organizer. It was published in 1993 by SUNY Press, that's S-U-N-Y, State University of New York Press. And you can get it through that major book distributor whose name shall go unmentioned. And you can probably order it also from bookstores and so on. And in case you've just joined us or have perhaps forgotten, let me remind you that you're listening to Older Women Live on CKUT 90.3. I'm Laura Yaris, your host for this episode. Okay, we're going to continue now with a conversation I had the other day with our sister collective member Rosemary Wally about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Given that Human Rights Day is on Friday, the theme of this year's Human Rights Day is equality, reducing inequalities, advancing human rights.
So we're going to talk about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
It was adopted by the UN in 1948 on December 10th, and that's why we commemorate this day.
Yes, that's why we celebrate every year. It was adopted, as you say, on December the 10th, 1948, after a lot of work. It was really the idea, probably originally, of Eleanor Roosevelt, the wife of the President of the United States. And it was in response to World War II. And World War II was, I mean, all wars are terrible, but this one was really, Laura. 70 million people died in World War II. That's like twice the population of Canada, and then some. It was not just in Germany, it was not just the Holocaust thing. It was, I mean, there were 27 million Russians, for a start. And, of course, there were people, a lot of people in China as a result of Japanese invasion, people
yeah,
in Japan, people everywhere. So it was considered at that point, the UN, quite rightly, considered that there had to be some kind of way of protecting people by giving them, as individuals, certain rights. I mean, I think it's both good and bad. I mean, it's good to have certain individual rights, but of course, collective rights are also very important, and none of us seem to have that. I mean, we only have to look at the refugee problem today. Now, I mean, you have all kinds of rights. I don't know whether you have a list of them there. You can read some of them. We're all equal before the law. We're entitled to equal protection with no discrimination. We're entitled to the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. We have the right to food. You cannot be just arbitrarily arrested. You have the right to life, liberty, and the security of person, of course. You can't be tortured. All these things that you cannot be, they're just really, a lot of them are common sense. Yeah, you can't be just found guilty. You have to be, you know, there has to be a trial and a proper trial. There's no arbitrary interference. People cannot legally just walk into your house. You know, the privacy of your house and your family, these are sacred rights as well. But I don't know what's happening now in terms of the 84 million refugees at the moment. Some of them are refugees, some of them are displaced within their own country, and of course we're getting more and more and more refugees with climate change. I don't think that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is in any way equipped to deal with our actual situation.
Well, that's true. I mean, clearly, if you look at what's going on today, you can see that these rights have not been implemented the way they were set out in 1948. I was just looking on the United Nations website and about the International Human Rights Day, and they are talking about something called the 2030 Agenda. And when I clicked on that link, they have 17 goals that they want to achieve between now and 2030, kind of a decade of activism or whatever. And that includes things like food security and the right to proper health care. I have the documents here. No poverty, zero hunger, good health and well-being, quality education, gender equality, clean water and sanitation, affordable and clean energy, decent work and economic growth, that's number 8, Number 9, industry, innovation, and infrastructure. Reduced inequalities. Sustainable cities and communities. Responsible consumption and production. Climate action. Life below water, like, I guess, you know, the preservation of our oceans and bodies of water. Life on land. Peace, justice, and strong institutions. And then something called partnerships for the goals. Now, if you go on that, on the UN website for the Declaration of Human Rights, and you click on the 2030 agenda, and each of these goals, you can click and read more about each of them and elaborate on all of these. So this is what they're trying to achieve between now and 2030.
Okay, so this is their idea.
That's the idea of the United Nations.
The idea of the UN, yes. Well, so far, what it was supposed to achieve, like Article 13, everyone has the right to freedom of movement and residence within the borders of each state. Everyone has the right to leave any country, including his own, and to return to his country. Well, as we can see with the refugee crisis.
Well, yeah, that's not happening, clearly.
Well, it's not only it's not happening, it's not on anybody's agenda. So this is a document, really, that's historic. It's an old document. It's not being taken seriously for a contemporary situation, I don't think.
No, it's not. I mean, it needs to be updated, and I see with some of the 17 goals I just read out, I think that's an attempt maybe to update that. But the thing is, the thing that I don't get is the UN, how respected a body is it really, and what kind of authority does it really have, right, realistically?
Well, it doesn't have any, does it? It doesn't have any legal authority. It's just an advisory role, really.
Exactly. You know, there's no way to enforce all of these goals and all of these rights. So this is the problem, because clearly these principles are not being practiced in many countries, and certainly the ones that practice some of them don't practice all of them.
Well, I think also, I don't know, I haven't looked this one up, Laura, maybe you have, but I wonder what the world's population was in 1948 when Eleanor Roosevelt and René Cassin, the French gentleman, and our very own John Humphrey from McGill Law School and a couple of others sat down to come up with this declaration. What was the population at that time? Because now we're approaching 8 billion people.
I didn't look up what the population figures were in 1948. But of course, you know, the population, it was kind of artificially reduced because of all the deaths that happened during the war. It was reduced at that time. And then I think that, you know, in the 50s, when people were rebuilding and so on, I mean, that's why they call it the baby boom, right? There was a huge increase
in the West.
I mean, I imagine it's different in the Eastern countries and so on. But certainly in the West, you had this baby boom and there was a big increase in the population. But nowadays, the population has increased a lot more. It just keeps multiplying. And how much can the planet sustain?
Well, also with the climate crisis, you know, global warming and so forth, you've now got huge areas of the world which have been reduced to droughts.
That's right. Food supplies, there's much more food insecurity than there used to be. I mean, even
much
here.
More food insecurity, yes.
Even here in Canada, there's food banks. And just last night, I was watching the news and they were talking about the supplies of turkeys, apparently because of the flooding that's going on in BC, and they must supply turkeys from BC. Who knew? So apparently all the food banks that used to give out free turkey to their clients, there's not enough supplies now, and they have to substitute chickens instead.
Yes, and I mean, this is, of course, a nothing thing here. I mean, we're still going to eat, aren't we? But if you can imagine places like Afghanistan, which have got no welfare system whatsoever, they're in a situation of post-war, just about post-war. The US has taken and is holding their bank reserves of $9 billion or something and will not give them back because the US doesn't like the Taliban as the government. And the people are literally dying of starvation on the streets. It's cold, There's a huge drought, so there's no water in the villages. The springs have dried up. The wells have dried up. I mean, the situation is beyond catastrophic. But, I mean, we also do not get proper news coverage of these places, do we? I mean, I happen to know people from Afghanistan, so I can get so-and-so's brother reports this or that or whatever. But most people have no idea, and even if we know Afghanistan, we don't know other places in the world where the same situation is happening.
And we're just about out of time, so I'll remind you that you're listening to Older Women Live on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. My name is Laura Yaris, and I've been your host for this evening. Thanks to Rosemary Wally for her contributions to this episode, and thanks again to Professor Elaine Leader for that wonderful and fascinating interview. I'd like to express my greetings to everyone this holiday season, whether your holiday has already happened or is about to take place shortly. Enjoy, and please do be aware of all the public health regulations so that we can all stay well and safe. We're going to leave you now with a beautiful song by Sweet Honey in the Rock about the African-American holiday of Kwanzaa, which begins on December 26th. The song is called The Seven Principles, and I think it really relates to the human rights issues that we've just been discussing. Unity, self-determination, collective work and responsibility, cooperative economics, purpose, creativity, and faith. So have a wonderful holiday, and we'll see you all next year on January 12th. Take care.
Umoja,
unity that brings us together.
Umoja,
unity that brings us together.
Umoja,
unity that brings us together.
Listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
puisque ça fait plus d'un an qu'on le mentionne, et que de toute façon, vous le savez probablement déjà, on a décidé de ne pas vous le dire. Donc, on ne vous redira pas que pour se protéger de la COVID-19, il faut se laver les... On ne répétera pas encore une fois qu'il faut porter un... Et surtout, qu'il faut garder nos... avec les autres. Vous le savez, c'est la meilleure façon de combattre le virus, même lorsqu'on est vacciné. On continue de se protéger. Un message du gouvernement.
Oh,